Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. Oh, are we so happy to be back on the air today. It's a summer day and we're having a good time. I have a wonderful guest, but as usual, I want to do a little housekeeping before we start because we have new people who are tuning in for the first time, and I want them to understand how they can call in and ask questions or how they can review the archives that have over 70 episodes now of Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. First, let me tell you, you are on blogtalkradio.com, and it is / S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. That's what you need, those last numbers. You need them so that you can get specifically to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser and view any of the episodes or listen to any of the episodes that have gone by since 2021. Now, I want to say to you that if you want to call in, and the board is filling up, now that you're calling in, if you have a question or a comment and you want to ask that of myself or my guest, you've already dialed 516-453-6063. And if you haven't, that's what you can do. And then you press the number 1 because then I'll know that you have a question, and I hope we have some questions for my wonderful guest this evening. So let me get right to it. My guest's name is Richard Finkelstein, and he is a designer in the areas of scenery, lighting, and or projection design. I can tell you personally that his work is absolutely fabulous. He has designed a few shows that I have been in, and we'll talk about that. But his work has been seen all over the world. Israel, Russia, Italy, Canada, and he's designed off-Broadway shows. He's worked with the National Theater of the Deaf. He's worked at the Colorado Shakespeare Festival and the New York State Theater Institute. He is an associate professor of stage design at James Madison University, and he's taught at other places like Cincinnati's College Conservatory of Music and at the University of Colorado Boulder and at SUNY Stony Brook. He is the official photographer for the U.S. International Ballet Competition since 2006. Now, I have abbreviated some of his history, and this is just, he's condensed it. So I'm going to welcome him, and then we're going to hear about Richard's fabulous trip about in his career. And I want to welcome you, Richard. Hello, how are you?
Hello, I am fine. This is such a nice reunion for us.
Oh, it is wonderful. What if those people have had time, they have seen the collage of your work, and I put up two different collages on Facebook. And what is really wonderful to see is I go back and I was able to see my wonderful set for Ladies of Song, but then also was witness for the prosecution. I believe we had Three Penny Opera, and I'm not sure what the last one was. Oh, Amadeus. That's what it was. And so then we had pictures, and you did such a great collage of pictures of the historic pioneers of dance, that Black Americans. And then you had in this collage, you had beautiful pictures of some of our more familiar actors. So you do everything, Richard. So tell me something. I want to ask you eventually where you want to go with all this, but I want to know, and we've not discussed this, where did it all start? Where were you? Where are you originally from? And when did you really think about being a designer in your life? And if it was when you were 3 years old and were asked not to be in a show, tell me about it.
Well, I was always interested in design. I was always interested in theater, and I was always interested in science also, actually, which is a wonderful combination. My mother was my first inspiration. She had gone to the Great Goodman Theater in Chicago and around the war time. And some of her classmates became so famous, I just forgot their name. One of the great O'Neill directors was one of her class. Well, growing up in Chicago, they were doing a television show. Chicago was one of the centers of television, and they were doing a special on the life of a very famous Jewish cantor who does the singing in the service. And I was cast as the cantor as a three-year-old because I was 3 years old. And I was apparently adorable, and somehow I could sing all the right blessings, which is funny because later I couldn't. But at three, I could. And so we were at the Opera House in Chicago. And there I was rehearsing, and I was apparently adorable and beautiful, and they were all happy. And then came the dress rehearsal. And they turned on all the lights and the cameras. And there I was. I still sung fine, but I was so interested in those lights and cameras. I was shifting around and looking this way and looking that way. And they couldn't deal with that, and they fired me. And they hired my five-year-old brother. But the interesting thing is, later on, it was the technical side that caught me after college, actually. So it's always nice to have a fallback. And I tell people whose parents tell them that going into theater that why not make your fallback theater also? So I just switched from the performance side to the design side.
So you say you were always interested in theater, but you didn't know specifically until, I mean, now once that happened, you realized your fascination then was with the lights and what they were doing, how they made you feel. What made you wiggle so much? What made you wiggle? What made you look
at the... I think I was interested. It's like even animals, you have activity around. That's what they look at, you know. Or think of a baby in a crib with the spinning thing on top. That's what your eye goes to. And I actually still have a memory of that. I don't have a memory of the context. I had no idea what I was doing there, but I do remember all the cool toys.
Well, now, let me ask you. Now we'll start there, and we're going to come all the way here. What do you think about what you've accomplished all these years later? And then we'll get to what you've accomplished. What do you think about it? What kind of footprint do you think you'd like to make in the world?
Yeah, that gets a little sad because you always wish you accomplished more, and people always wish they accomplished different things. But one thing I've been working on more and more lately is the idea of our history, because, you know, in theater and in dance, it's also ephemeral. It all disappears. You can film something, but that doesn't capture what it was to be there live.
Exactly.
And there are so many greats that made it possible. We stand on all their shoulders.
Yes.
So I've been working on so many projects dealing with that history and dealing with with all these incredible people that we maybe never even heard of, but it was our ignorance and not they didn't do stuff. And also the fact that the arts are not separate from society, but are central to what a society and a culture is, and way beyond just that it's pretty or a part of the heart, but actually society was built on the arts. And I'll give you a super quick example. In Colorado, I was very active in arts advocacy, and we had a meeting with the legislature for Arts Day where we brought in the vice president of the Lockheed Martin Company, who had head that year of the Business Committee for the Arts. And and this was right after some of the old-timers will remember when Chrysler was getting ready to fold in the 90s. And Lee Iacocca came in, and they thought he was a genius for saving the company. Well, the vice president said something amazing. He said, it wasn't Lee Iacocca that saved Chrysler. It was the fact that their designers of the company invented the concept of the minivan. And you saw the legislators' eyes light up that, oh, my God, our economic success depends on art. And, you know, people aren't used to thinking in those kinds of terms. So I'm very cross-disciplinary, and I collect those examples of where the arts are central to who we are as human and not just periphery.
Well, you know, now, Richard, with all that you've done, and you've done so many different levels of design. You've designed on the road in different countries. You've designed off-Broadway. You've designed in regional theater. You've designed in the college arena. What is it that you think that when you said you always think that there was something else that you could do. What is it that you think, what else you could do? I mean, because you have this historic historic mission that you create. You sent me all this wonderful information, and we'll talk about this later. But I really think that you should have your own podcast where you announce all of the anniversaries of each month of things that are related to the theater that people don't know. What else do you think that you could possibly have done?
It's almost a matter of reputational kind of matter. What was that movie? Was it Turning Point? The movie with Shirley MacLaine.
Shirley MacLaine.
Where the two dancers.
Yes.
And one went in one direction and one went in the other. I've always been afraid of the freelance world, which design is basically a freelance area. So that's why I went into teaching, because it gave me full employment for 50 years. But when you do that, certain avenues close off to you, and partly because I don't turn out shows like 10 a year. And in some instances, that allows some of my shows to be better because I could spend time on it. But I don't have the same misfortune that goes with being like a Broadway star kind of thing. But even in photography also, I'm pretty well known in the industry. But it's not like someone that does that only and all the time who can have the wide reach, publishing industry, et cetera. So you always have those kinds of regrets. But I'm happy with my work.
You should be. I mean, you know, I understand what that is. But I also think that it is it's an added ability, you know, because sometimes the people who only do that for their commercial success, that is what they can only do. Not everyone, because they design, because they act, because they sing, can teach. Teaching is an art in itself, you know, and that you sustained a decades of teaching is an amazing thing. Yeah. And so I don't want you to shortchange yourself, because sometimes all of that eventually, I mean, if the fat lady has not sung, so you're still working, you know, something will come past, I believe, that will bring you that additional recognition, but your ability to design and the eye that you have, and to be able to pass it on to your students, that's a gift. You know, that's a gift. Don't underestimate that gift. Fabulous.
And it's funny how many times two gifts have a downside to them. For instance, I wear a lot of different hats, And I know performers have the same thing when they get famous in a role and then people discount their ability to do different roles.
Oh, yes.
When I go in to photograph a show as a photographer, very often the people won't give me the time of day because I'm just the photographer and they have no idea I have a separate career. And I'm more expert in their field sometimes than they are even. And sometimes when they find out, they magically change their attitude towards me.
Yes, they do.
But it's interesting. People typecast you when they meet you. So,
absolutely.
But yet working in different areas allows you to be stronger to the areas because they cross-pollinate each other.
Exactly. I think it's very similar when you go on a set or you are around people who are not used to your work for the first time, and they call it the first day of school, the rehearsal. And it is, people don't pay you any attention, none whatsoever. They figure, you know, they don't know who you are, and they figure you haven't done anything that they know of, so you can't be important. And
well,
then,
you hit on something cool. People define, I realize this from students, I'll bring up some of the people who are like the most important people in the arts and history, and my students will go like, huh, who's that? I don't know them. You know, they're not Beyonce. And I came up with a fun definition of fame, which is somewhat derogatory, that someone's only famous if you've heard of them. And we don't recognize our own ignorance, that we only have a limited set of people we have heard of. And to assume that's all that's out there, it makes us kind of ignorant. And I've learned the hard way many times myself.
Oh, I told you the story about Lloyd Richards taking me to the O'Neill. How I met Lloyd was I was in a class at Hunter College that was a Black History class, and it was supposed to be taught by an actor who had done a scene. Mind you, he died in the first scene of one of the Shaft movies. So he was, you know, it was a day player kind of. But he was a lovely actor, lovely person who was going to teach this theater history class. So I thought, I just transferred to Hunter. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to start off with it. And in walks this little man with a cane limping. And I went, who is this person? This is not the actor. I had no idea. Whoever was famous that I knew, that was my limitation. Everyone else in the class knew who he was. I had no idea who he was. And then, of course, that was before the days of Google. So I went up after hearing his name, and he was not forthcoming on any information about himself. He was about talking about the history. And I looked him up, and when I found out who he was, having been the first director on Broadway and directed Raising the Sun, I was glued to him, of course, until graduation. But it taught me, when I walk into the room, to empower everybody, that everybody in there could be famous. It's just that I don't know about it.
Yeah, that's
how I look at it. I mean, when people say to me, well, you know, well, Lenny, what do you think? I said, if I don't hear from people, people have come up to me in their own, and I don't believe it's their, it's malicious. It's their own bit of ignorance sometimes. And they'll say, well, I was wondering what happened to you. And I went, what happened to me? I've been working. I mean, what happened to me? I never think about that. I always figure everybody I know is working. That's how I figure it. You're working. That's it. And if I don't see you, I may not know what you're doing, but I know you're going to be fabulous in it. So it's a state of mind that you put yourself into. So when I go into a new project, if I don't know anybody there, I just assume that they all are on the same level and have the same experience that I do, you know. And then it's up to them to prove me wrong, but until they do, that's what it is. So tell me. This has always been a curiosity for me, and we've closely been working on a show that I did all by myself, so I know that we've worked on a set. But when you get a script, how does it start to materialize for you? What is it that you start thinking about, or do you think about something before you get the script?
It's hard to think about things before you get the script, because then that means you have an agenda that's independent of the script, and the agenda really needs to start with the words. Now, there's a difference between if it's a new script or a script that's already been done. Because I started college actually as an English major, and I wasn't frankly that great at it, but a lot caught on to me. And I came up with this theory that everyone in the theater, all the artists, and there are many kinds of artists, there's actors, directors, choreographers, music copyists, they're all artists. And all of us have the same job, and it's not to entertain, because there are far more things entertaining than theater, actually. So our job is to communicate ideas. And mm-hmm. any one of us can do that. So the question is, who could do it more efficiently? So for instance, when I work with a writer, I go, how can what I create as the environment of the play, how can that further what the writer is trying to tell an audience? So in that sense, the set becomes part of the writing, and it becomes part of the acting, because that's also the job of the performer, is to communicate the ideas. So the important thing is to start with, what is the point of this piece? What is it trying to say? Then I found out through working with students that people think in terms of like postcards. An example I give with students is I'll say, Cinderella, what's that story about? And I'll say, love conquers all. If you think about it, to start with, that's an absolute lie. I mean, everyone's been in love, and what has it conquered? Plus, why are you thinking of the word love and conquering at the same time? So that's not what that show's about. What it's about is all that question dealing with on the topic of love. Who can have it? Why can they have it? Why do some people earn it, et cetera? And I call that the second about of the show. The first about is the plot line. But the second about is, why is that plot even there? How does an audience supposed to act differently when they leave the theater than when they come in? And my most successful shows are certainly the ones that can address that, where what I do can help an audience think in a different way, and one that supports what the playwright and the director are also hoping that an audience can do. And so, those are the most successful.
So what you're saying to me is that, did you learn more from your students after you started teaching than you knew before? Did the students open your as an educator? Yeah,
this sounds like a backhand compliment, but one, I love teaching Introduction to Theater and wish more of our faculty taught it. Often they think, okay, I'm going to teach the advanced courses. But it's so interesting to see how the non-theater people think, because that gives me a path of how I can change their own behavior. Like on this question of fame, if I can give them that same appreciation that you just mentioned, of realizing that everyone has their worth, and it's our job to find out what that worth is. So for instance, the fact that students think entertainment is what theater is about, I can put them on a better path. And why this is important, the companies that go in just to entertain, they're the ones that are failing. And I think in terms of like classical music, all the orchestras that are failing. And the ones that have succeeded are like Leonard Bernstein's, where he was there to train the audience to appreciate more than what's the jewel, the sparkly thing of the moment, trying to train them to be better audiences. And there's a tradition of that. And I'll give an example from the Denver Center Theater Company, where we had a meeting with the artistic director and asked, how do you choose a season? Now, they were wildly successful, sold out every play they ever did. And he asked, and he had a wonderful formula. And his formula was, they go out into a community and they find what's on the minds of the people in the community, and then they address it.
Okay.
When theater can reflect what's on people's minds in a way that gets them to think in a different way, then that's a success. And when I can do that with students, that's when I'm at the best there.
What about photography then? And so what is the different approach that you have when you're now assigned to go, say, to a session of the International Ballet Competition? Okay. What's on your mind?
Yeah.
What trying to capture there, and what's on your mind there?
Oh, that's so fun. First, it's It's not like Dance Moms. The one I work with in Jackson, Mississippi, was one of the original four competitions. It was actually founded by the United Nations, by UNESCO. And we have people from the top companies from all over the world, and I've got to meet the directors from the Bolshoi, et cetera. So these are young dancers, but at the top of the pinnacle. But so much then depends on their performances. And yet a lot of the documentation of what they comes from people like me, the photographer. So mm-hmm. many of the photographers come just from the press, and they don't understand dance, and they don't understand what dance is trying to achieve. So since I've been part of the dance community and the theater community, I know very well, and that's been one of my edges, is that I can capture them at the moments to communicate. And I've found where I'm actually strongest. This competition involves not just the ballet, but modern dance also. And I find a lot of the other photographers have a problem because they've been able to memorize the moments to take pictures of ballet, the moments where the dancer is at peak form. But they mm-hmm. don't have a clue when it comes to the modern dance then, because it's not something that's canned. They don't repeat
yes.
the same performances for 100 years.
Yes. Yes.
But I understand
yes.
the language of movement well enough, and I understand the design side, because even ballet started as lines in space and creating a beautiful geometry that then reflects in the body. And the same, frankly, with modern dance. They are creating shape. I've heard dance called sculpture in time. And so I put on my designer hat. It all fertilizes each other. And in fact, some of the great designers on Broadway were photographers. Cecil Beaton, who did the designs for the costumes in the original My Fair Lady, was also a great photographer. Lewis Carroll was a great photographer. And photography, one of the inventors of photography was Daguerre. And he was the scenic artist at the Paris Opera. So there's an affinity between theater, dance, and photography right there.
Your notes tell me that you were on the cover of the text, Acting is Believing.
Yes.
Why?
Well, not me, but one of my shows. So it was a production of Hamlet.
Okay. What did you capture that made it a cover photo?
Well, one thing that was interesting about that show is it was a very unique design, and the design was also exhibited in Prague. It was done through a class at the university, at James Madison University, where the students with their professor were tasked to write a new version of Macbeth, or it's Macbeth, but setting it in a different world. And they chose the world of a train station. The problem with that was we had an $1,100 budget. And they wanted the trains to come and go. So I thought of some of the essence of theater. Some of the essence of theater is conflict and letting a conflict drive a plot, and a plot of ideas, because it's the ideas that are conflicting. And one thing Shakespeare used to do with his plays was find a place where conflict naturally happens. In a way, movies still do this. So that's why you have so many movies set in the workplace, in the sports arena, places where conflict, people are drawn together in conflict. And I thought, forget the train. It's the train station together from all these different walks of life. And so I suggested moving it into a train station, and I made all the walls transparent so you can get the shadows of the trains going by. And it became very monumental. It was like four stories high for the $1,100. And it struck so many people's fancy that people look at that design, and the performers are framed in so beautifully. They look so important. And that's why that was chosen as the cover. And everyone knew it was Hamlet right away from the gestures of the performers. So it communicated all that. But it was just such a striking visual. And it really was. It's one of my favorite two designs.
Well, now, let me ask you. I mean, you're fascinating to listen to.
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah.
When I was growing up in Baltimore in high school, where UB Blake grew up, I was actually in a Peter Pan at the Lyric Theater in 1968. I was a lost boy. I was doing photography even then. I started in fourth grade, and this was for the Baltimore Actors Theater. And my pictures would get in the Sun Papers, which is one of the top newspapers in the country, and I learned an important lesson. that publishers have secret rules. You would know this as an actor in auditions. There's certain things you do, you will not get the job because people in the industry know this rule and people that are not part of the industry do not know the secret code. One of the rules, for instance, that the Sun Papers have, and someone told me these, I'm so happy I learned these, was you have to have something in every corner of the photograph. Photograph will bleed off into the newsprint and you won't see that sharp edge that they want. So by learning these technical rules, that immediately started to give me an edge. And from Ansel Adams, who I never met, but I certainly knew his work, I learned proper exposure. And from work in the darkroom, I knew what makes a great photograph tonality-wise, and then my arts training. And so I found I was able, almost every time I submit to something, I get in, because my photographs fit what the publishers require of a photograph. And it's a good metaphor for theater, where the same thing, that the artists are, of an actor, and certainly the talent and those things, but there's the technology of acting. There's the external training that comes to play, and those who have mastered that, those who can speak properly, be heard, all those kinds of things, that gives the edge that fewer and fewer people are trained in anymore.
Yes, they are. What? Where did you go to college? Tell me again.
I went, that's a really cool story too. Well, for graduate work, I went to Carnegie Mellon University, which is such a wonderful place. Mm-hmm. And so many greats have come out of there in history. It was the first theater program in America, actually. Mm-hmm. But before that, I went to a liberal arts college, a small one called, then it was Wilkes College in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. A lot of people don't realize that was once the center of the theater world, actually, and then the money world. The great designer Santa LaCosta went to the neighboring college, King's College there. Mm-hmm. And so many greats came out of there. But there was a Broadway designer who came in to teach there like the year before I got there. He helped design the building. His name was Klaus Holm, to that name. And he was Donna Loenflager's associate. And because it was a liberal arts college, they didn't have much staff. So he did set design, lighting design, and technical direction. So as students, we got to work with him, with the master on every show. It was like the old days of apprenticeship. But mm-hmm. the cool part was his mother, Hanya Holm, was one of the four founders of modern dance. And on Broadway, she did such little shows as Camelot, Kiss Me, Kate, and what's the other big one? Kiss Me, Kate, Camelot, and My Fair Lady. So, like Klaus's daughter, Julie Andrews, is their godmother. I'm very jealous. And Hanya Holm would come by all the time. And when I would go to New York, I'd stay at her house. And it was such an influence. Among other things, she was the first ever copyright movement. And since I was interested in physical theater at the time, I really took notice. I actually went and studied some Le Bon and those things, and it influenced my design afterwards. We're creating lines in space, just like he was doing with performers. But it was such an inspiration to grow up around people like that, that I hold that opportunity so dear.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I think those of us who are blessed to have been exposed to another generation. What was that quote that you said earlier?
Oh, I love it. I love it. It was over the library at University of Colorado in Boulder. And it's funny, they didn't say who the quote was from. And later on, I found out they plagiarized. The university carved in stone some plagiarism. But the original quote came from Cicero, the Roman general. And it goes, "He who knows but one generation remains a child." And that changed my life when I saw that, because
you know,
it's so true. And that's true.
You know, I really live that, because I now know two men who live to be 100. One was Ubi Blake and the other is Norman Lear. And it is a gift to be exposed to people who have such great history. And I just would stay around them and soak everything up. You know, I have to tell you, in my life, I miss a lot of the people now, not because, I mean, we've been in life, we've been through several plagues, and one plague was the AIDS plague, and it it eliminated a lot of very talented people and a lot of younger people. But the thing that time really took a lot of people out of my life that I studied with and that I admired and I listened to very early on, because by the time I got to them, they were in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and had, you know, and they had, I would say, a limited amount of time still to be on this earth. But being exposed to them was absolutely, I think it is the reasons why I have the principles that I have now. And I am old school, straightforward. There's no, anyone who knows me knows that I'm just old school, forget about it, you know, and that's what I admire the most. I really do admire. I do believe that our parents belonged to the greatest generation, that they sacrificed more than anybody else for this country and for us to have a life that we're not quite living up to right now, but for us to have the life that they wanted for us, that there wasn't another generation that did that. That was, they were selfless, a lot of them, and that we were very, very lucky to have been exposed to them. So I say all of that, I get off my soapbox, and then I ask you another question. If you had an opportunity, if I say to you, you know, I had one question I wanted to ask you, what question would you like me to ask you?
Well, one that's sort of on your blog's mission, and I actually made notes, is some of the examples I mentioned at the start of how history was changed by theater, how theater is the central. And I'd love to go through some of those, and I could do it even in lightning speed. I get that from students a lot, as parents want to dissuade them from going into the arts, say, well, you can't make money at it, or you can't have a career, and that's so far from the truth. But they don't have a retort because it's never taught. And I'd love to go through some of those people and things.
Go through a couple. Go through a couple. Just go through a couple.
Okay, well, I find out some of these I do with students, especially get intro to theater, the ones who aren't even in theater. I point out, I do a little trivia thing. I say, name the two world leaders in your lifetime who were actually theater people that headed their own countries. And one of them, they often get the first one, was Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
But another one that most of them don't realize is that John Paul, Pope John Paul, was a theater person. He was trained as a playwright and as an actor. And actually, when I went to Italy, it was at the invitation of our company, the New York State Theater Institute, were invited by the Pope himself when he first became Pope. And now he's a saint. And the other one is the first free leader of the Czech Republic, Václav Havel, who's one of history's great playwrights. A lot of the words, you know, the single person who contributed the most words to the English language, most people know this, is Shakespeare. Interesting is who is second, and that's Dr. Seuss, actually. The artificial heart. The artificial heart was developed by a ventriloquist, Paul Winchell. I mentioned Daguerre. The first Peter Pan in America, Maud Adams, was the one who also was an engineer with General Electric, who invented the 1,000-watt light bulb. When Bill Clinton was running for president, you might remember he lost his voice right at the end. The people that got his voice back were the Wilbur Gould Voice Research Center at the Denver Center. Then the Empire State Building with all that beautiful lighting on top, that was originally designed by Abe Fader, who did the original Camelot. And I was so pleased as a teacher when I learned recently that the person doing it now was one of my students in Boulder, who's one of the lighting designers for the Empire State Building. One of my classmates got called into Congress to first redesign the lighting in the Senate and just this year redesign the lighting in the House of Representatives, because if you think about it, it's one of the most important television studios in the world is the U.S. Capitol. You don't realize that theater people are at the center of that. And the conventions, both Republican and Democrats, tend to be designed by my classmates. from Carnegie Mellon. Another interesting one is theater is a cure for stuttering, or at least contemporary. Some of the most famous actors were stutterers, like James Earl Jones, people don't realize, was a stutterer. Peter Jennings on the news was a stutterer. And Lewis Carroll himself, that's why I think he went into theater. People don't realize he knew all the greats in theater as well as mathematics and literature. Parkinson's disease. We now have a program in our dance program. Parkinson's can be mitigated incredibly through dance because it turns out the movements Parkinson's people can't do is in one part of the brain, which is the habitual movement, but the learned movement is spared from Parkinson's. So if you learn choreography, you can move in ways that you can't move without that knowledge. There's a number, the largest health maintenance plan in the country now has 8 different theater programs going. I ask my students this, and they never guess why. But the reason why is the way an insurance company makes money is that people don't get sick. And they started with one program for kids to teach them healthy living. And they found their bottom line increased because the kids weren't getting sick, injured, and kidnapped, et cetera. So they started one for teens, dealing with teen issues. And their numbers went in the right direction. Then they started one for old age people. So they used theater as a way of teaching. It's, of course, central to many forms of therapy. There's a form of therapy called playback theater. People don't realize the symbol you see of doctors and medicine, the two snakes around the staff. That came from the great Greek theater at Epidaurus, which was also a hospital because theater was considered a healing art. And in psychology, the word persona, our persona, that actually is the word for mask. The Greek masks were persona because that is not only your personality, but the public-facing personality, what you show to the rest of the world as opposed to what's inside of you, the private. So all that kind of theory going back to Greek times comes out of the theater. Helen Keller was a vaudeville actress, believe it or not. And I'll leave you with one last one. Even various articles of clothing come from the theater. When you hear about, when you think of Indiana Jones, you think of the fedora hat. Fedora was a character in a French play, and the hat was originally for women, so it transferred over. And the other fun one is every time you wear pants, realize that comes from the Commedia dell'arte character Pantalone. This is the beginning. World War II was won in large part by theater artists. First, the camouflage was all designed by Broadway designers. The man who did Cabaret, Boris Aronson, was a camouflage designer. But also there was a magician out of England that came up with a way to make whole cities disappear from the German bombers. And they allowed him to form a whole unit of just magicians. And I keep hearing Spielberg's making a movie about it, but it never seems to come out. So those are my quick examples.
Oh, my gosh. See, now I need to have you come back at least once a month so that we can have just something, a review of what we should know about something for the month of, say, September or the month of November. See, I'm going to work
on that.
Oh,
that I could do.
Yeah. Oh,
that,
I
that
have
would be
to,
fun because I keep that history.
Now, you know, one of the things that I want people to know that we are probably only about 12, 13 minutes left in the show. I mean, see how fast it goes. But, there's so much information. I want people to know there are a couple of things that, you know, I ask all my guests to try to write in some of the things that have happened to them in their lives and some things that they, you know, remember. One of the things that you have down here that's memorable is a day working with Lillian Gish. Can you talk about that, please?
Oh, that was just so affirming. That was so nice. At Wilkes College, the little school, they would bring in the most amazing people. And sometimes they were very famous, like Lillian Gish. Sometimes they weren't, but then became famous. Like they brought in, I forget his name now, the man who went on to write A Christmas Story, that, you know, with the lake lamp. He came in to speak with us.
Oh,
and when I realized how important this was, Gene Roddenberry came in. When I realized how important this stuff was, I made a rule for myself to go to the mall. But I was the projectionist for the theater department. And through Donald Onslager and my teacher, they brought in Lillian Gish. And for those who don't know, she was one of the great stars of the silent film era, along with her sister. And in fact, she was known, she disputed it some, and I just figured out why, but she was basically the first close-up in feature film history. And she told all these stories and showed the evidence of these stories. She showed film clips that no one in the world could see, you know, because she had the rights to them that no one else could see, and the stories were amazing. In that case, it was D.W. Griffith directing that film, and he was almost fired for it. The producer above him said, I hire you to film whole actors, not parts of actors. But in any event, I was the projectionist on it, and at the end we were at a party, and she was there, and I was introduced to her. And she found out I was the projectionist running all her film clips. And she was so grateful. She was so appreciative. And, you know, that doesn't always happen for somebody. I was just a student then. And she kept her career going on Broadway and in films until near 100. I know in the 80s she was still on Broadway.
Yes. Still doing films. And I remember some of the television
shows. Yes, The Whales of August was one of her films. She was so nice and so great. And you don't always get that from people. There are some people who won't give you the time of day unless they think you're famous, too. And I could name some names. but she was not that way.
Yes, we can both name many of those names, which is nice.
And there are people like that. There are people, for instance, you hear about all these marriage breakups and that. There are some people, like I work with Jack Guilford. Oh, you did too
at Knickerbocker Collie. Yes.
Yeah, and he brought in his wife. They were married for 50 years. Why don't people hear those stories?
Yeah, I know.
People would have normal life.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had a son, and his son, I remember, was always so very, very attentive about the imagery of his father. I don't know. I have not heard from him in years. But it was a wonderful family, you know, Jack Guilford. And again, working with someone and those people who don't know, sometimes people don't realize who Jack is. He did...
Cocoon was one of his later movies.
Cocoon was one of... But wasn't, didn't he did a Funny Thing That Ever Happened in the Way to the...
Yep, he was in Funny Thing, the movie of Funny Thing Happened in the Way to the Forum. He was in the original Diary of Anne Frank. And he was in Cabaret.
And he was. And
the
Meat Kite
song.
I tell you what people will remember. He was the man who did the Cracker Jack commercial.
Yeah.
He did Cracker Jack. Isn't that funny when
people remember that stuff?
Yeah, it's amazing. But you know what's wonderful about it is that probably he made more money from that than he did from anything else. In our business, that's how it goes, and that's the most memorable thing. But he was absolutely a wonderful man to work with, and we did it again, and Orson Bean came later after to replace Jack, and he was wonderful to work with.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Yeah, he really was.
A lot of the actors, I was so angry at a lot of the actors, but a lot of them did not respect Jack Guilford. I don't know if you sensed that, because they didn't realize he was brought in at the last minute, and he was already quite elderly, and the script was very difficult. He narrated through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So from his vaudeville days, he created the persona of the absent-minded professor, which allowed him to keep notes with him, because he only had 1 week of rehearsal to do this giant Broadway-style show. And a lot of the actors were upset over that, but he didn't know enough to memorize all his lines. Well, give me a break. He was like in his 80s and only had 1 week of rehearsal on a brand new play that no one's done before, and he made it work because of his incredible vaudeville talent. And there
I think my memory is, well, that's one of the things. I came in replacing someone, replacing a wonderful actress, Gail Nelson, who had gone on to do Lady Day Bar and Grill. And so I came in as a replacement, and I remember being so in awe of him, knowing some of his credits, but knowing him from television also. And he was just delightful. He was delightful to be on stage with. I didn't pick that up from anybody. Well, they didn't say it around me. I didn't pick that up. from anyone.
Oh, well, good.
No, I didn't. I mean, because I just adored him. I absolutely adored him, his wife. It was a wonderful experience. And it was, you know, what has happened in my career is that I have always been peppered into productions with these really wonderful, great personalities of another era. You know,
yeah.
And I'm working with Bea Richards, working with UB Blake, working with, you know, I mean, those kinds of people. And you just sit and, you know, with knowing Maya Angelou, just sit and listen to what they've accomplished. It's absolutely an incredible gift in life. And I don't, you know, a lot of people go, Lenny, you've had a career. No one knows. Well, there's nothing to talk about. It's to do, you know.
Yeah.
Really,
well, and it wasn't just that they came from the past. A lot of them were trained through the vaudeville era.
Yes.
And I think that was the best training ground ever. They did up to 8 shows a day. If
mm-hmm.
if you weren't perfect, they threw stuff at you. I mean, Chaplin came out of that. Some of the great television writers, Sid Caesar, Neil Simon came out of that era.
Yeah.
And the discipline required.
Yes.
The Marx Brothers.
Hard work required. Hard work. And you know, I think you were relentless into getting it right. That's the whole thing.
Yep.
You know, I remember being at an audition one time, and I think we were at Stratford-on-Avon, some Shakespearean production, and a wonderful actress came out, beautiful woman. And, you know how you say, well, you know, break a leg. And she said, yes, but I have the rest of my life to get it right. And I never forgot
That's
that.
Cool.
Yes, it's really cool, you know.
Now,
really
can I assume there are a lot of performers in the audience? Because I have an interesting story about someone who inspired me.
Well, I think you should, because they listen in, yes.
Okay.
Yes, and
This is from the dance world at the ballet competition. I've seen some beyond belief performances, the kind that get instant standing ovations, and these people often go on to be incredible stars. And one I fell madly in love with from just watching her work was a Lithuanian dancer who became a real hero in Lithuania named Ruta Jezerskita. And in her modern dance piece, she was doing a piece to the Dying Swan, the Sanson piece, but it was based on a real dancer in Lithuania who didn't know when her career ended. She would still dance even though she couldn't dance, and the audience grew against her, but she would still go on, and she was like delusional. And this whole piece was showing that decline of her, and the real tragic decline, because she was the last to know it. And mm-hmm. when I saw Ruta do a rehearsal of this, and every finger was perfection, and you were in tears by the end of this. But then she did another rehearsal, and it was the same way. And another rehearsal, everything was absolutely perfect. And most dancers, when they're in those early rehearsals, you know, they'll line market for the lighting. She did it absolutely full out. Then she won a silver medal, and I was at the banquet with her, and I asked her about this. I said, I don't understand. You did it absolutely perfect every time you did it. And in her wonderful European accent, she turned to me. She just won my heart with this. She said, I love dance. Why would I do anything but 100%? And
mm-hmm.
I thought, wow, I wish all students saw that and saw, you know, where it took her, that fact that it had to be absolutely right every time she did it or it wasn't a rehearsal. I mean, I'd never seen that before. And the fact that it blew, I think I saw it 11 times and I cried every time at it. I'll always treasure that piece.
Well, not only students, but if performers could understand that is, I mean, every night is so very precious. I remember Lloyd used to say, you know, we are not asked often to perform. And when we are asked to perform, we should give 150% every time, especially to that person who really understands what it is. There's always one person in the audience that really gets it. And you do it for that one person every single time. You know?
Yep.
Every single time. It's an amazing life that we have in the arts. We're very, very blessed to do things that we really love. And Richard, you are really very good at it. And has where is your book? That's what I want to know. Are you writing a book?
Well, nowadays when you're a teacher at a university, it's all about meetings. And I'm like, my motto for our university, I think it's true of all of them now, is never have a meeting when tools suffice. So the time off I used to have to do those things. So what I've been doing is collecting material. So once I retire, I can write many books, maybe. I used to have lists of them, and especially since I'm in multiple fields. So we'll see about that.
Yes, please.
I mean,
one thing
I've done, and a lot of artists have this both positive and negative, is I think differently from other people, and it can get me in trouble, and sometimes controversially, but sometimes it gets you in trouble because if you're an innovator, no one cares, because to them what they value is the thing everyone's doing. Well, if you're the innovator, you're not doing what everyone is doing.
No, exactly.
And it gets
right.
very depressing when you don't get any credit, and then 10 years later someone does what you're doing, and then they get all the credit.
Well, let me give you this credit in the last few minutes of this show. I don't think that many people know how we worked together. Richard designed a show that I did called Ladies of Song. And I don't think that you understand the impact of what you designed had on my being able to make the transitions between the women of Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Ethel Waters, into finally becoming myself. It was, I remember when all
that
the
was
light,
fun.
It was great. It was not only fun for me. It sometimes you need that push to put it all together because you learn production. Yes.
Yeah. Can I explain to people what that effect was? And I'm proud because I did this before electronics. I mean, now you could do it so easily. We did it using 19th century magic. We had a dressing room set up, and she would look, and Lenny would look into the mirror, and she would morph into the singer. And this was done before video projection, before electronics, before anything. What I did, I had a plotter, so I had a computer at least, and I plotted out full-scale photographs of the three singers, and I had a triple mirror. And they were like the two-way mirror kind of things. And I put these full-length portraits behind. And all it was you'd see her reflection in the mirror, and then they would just put light on the back of it. And the light would come through the paper, and you would see the singer appear.
Yes.
So there were no electronics, no LED panels, none of that. I'm
no.
Really proud of that.
Nope. It came alive, and in its last minute, I only have a minute to talk about it. But in the rehearsal process, the script moved me along to the point where I would just keep going beyond even what the director thought. But when you put all of that together, it was seamless. Every time we did it, it was seamless, and it was a joy. And I have to say now that because we're down to the last minute, and I usually don't wait to the last minute to say anything, but I have to say, Richard, this has been absolutely a joy. Going down memory lane with you, going down any lane with you has been absolutely wonderful, and we're going to have you come back. But I'm going to say to my audience, thank you all for tuning in. Richard and I are going to do the after show after thoughts, and so you'll get a chance to see him and listen to more of his thoughts, and I'll see you on the radio on the next Lenny Guthrie Straight No Chaser. Be good now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is something we all know. fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever.